Thanks, everyone. So, I spoke with a woman named Julia several times earlier this month. She lives in Kyiv, but had traveled to Odessa, where she was born in mid-February. It was clear by then that something was going to happen, but nobody could imagine how bad it would be. Julia thought she might be gone for a couple weeks, not more. She didn't take much from her apartment in Kyiv. By the time she and I first talked, her life, like everyone else's in Ukraine, had been turned over and shaken into unrecognizability. She was spending her days in the basement of a museum, distributing food and medical supplies, and preparing for the inevitable bombing of the city. She knew it wasn't especially important, but she couldn't stop thinking about a book of poems she had left in Kyiv. Just a few months earlier, Julia had bought the book from its author, who's her favorite poet, and she'd asked the poet for her autograph. And after the poet had written the autograph, she held on to Julia tightly, as if they were friends, before saying goodbye. It was a small, like, human-scale moment that became, in the context of the hell of war, a sign of everything that was impossible, that might never be gotten back or redeemed. How do you locate God in a moment like this one, of incomprehensible violence and despair? One of the first things I noticed about the Book of Ruth, which is also set in a time of trauma and displacement, is that there's very little in it that obviously points to God. There is no divine intervention in Ruth, as Padraig Gotuma writes in his commentary on the book. There are just people doing their best in a sort of insane situation. Famine, three dead husbands, a situation that has not unfolded according to plan. The religion of my youth was one that promised a lot of divine interventions. If you believed enough, there would be miraculous healing, there would be good jobs and living husbands and children and general happiness and prosperity. There wasn't much of a roadmap for how to do your best in an insane situation. I don't recall ever reading the Book of Ruth, but I actually went back to my children's Bible from those days, which remains the only Bible I own, which introduced Ruth with a question: what happens in this book? And the response I was sort of amused and also a little bit dismayed to see was that Ruth, a young Moabite widow, travels to Israel with her Jewish mother-in-law and marries a good man there. The happily ever after take. I'm not much of a happily ever after guy these days. When I first read the section of Ruth that we're looking at today, my instinct was to be somewhat angry that this was the narrative in which I was required to locate a hopeful message about kindness, etc. Then I put it off until this afternoon. There was no longer any choice, and I wrestled with it for the last several hours. So this is fresh. The chapter that we're looking at begins with actually what I think is one of the tenderest lines in the book, but one that we don't talk about nearly as much as, you know, your people will be my people, which we talk about a lot. My daughter, Naomi tells Ruth, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. There's a lot of love in that line and care, and also an awareness that two widowed women, one of them foreign, are, because of the structures of their world, not really able to provide for themselves. Their lives, since the deaths of their husbands, had not been stable. Ruth had resorted to gleaning barley to get food for them. According to the law established in Leviticus, corner portions of fields should be left unharvested so that orphans and widows could gather grain there. We're told that this was hard work. Ruth is said to be on her feet from morning until night, and that it could also be dangerous. When Boaz sort of first appears in chapter 2, one of the first things he does is promise to make sure that the young men in the fields will not lay a hand on Ruth. Naomi realizes that gathering scraps is not sustainable, so she presents a plan. one involving perfume and getting dressed up and waiting for the right moment when a man with power is in the right mood, and uncovering his feet, which may or may not mean sex. All this is important because Boaz is the women's next of kin, which can also be translated as one with the right to redeem. A man who was next of kin was the only one who could, through marriage, pull a widow out of her ruined circumstances and make her whole, safe, invulnerable. Let's pause for a moment of just rage at this general state of affairs. There's so much we don't know about Ruth's desire in all of this. How much her actions were motivated by a desire for well-being and security, how much came from a desire for Boaz, for uncovered feet, for remarriage. In a context where remarriage was the only societally available path towards security, we could actually never know the answers to those questions. All the writer of this book tells us is that Ruth did everything Naomi asked her to do, with one exception. Naomi tells Ruth that after she has uncovered Boaz's feet and lay down, he would tell her what to do. But instead, when Boaz wakes up and finds her next to him, she doesn't wait, but asks for what she needs or wants. Spread your cloak over me, for you are next of kin. We aren't told anything about what Ruth was thinking here, but there are a few things we know. Most clearly is that when faced with an unimaginable set of circumstances, the kind which nobody can foresee or really prepare for, she determines her path forward as forcefully as she can. She refuses to return to her family, as Naomi repeatedly asks her to, and she pursues Boaz, who is obviously the best option for safety and security. Her choices were extremely limited by the broken, dysfunctional world in which she lived, a reality that was true thousands of years ago in Israel, as it is in Ukraine or in New York or anywhere else right now. We often say at St. Lydia's that our practice of faith is to find God in the daily dyings and risings all around us. This feels to me much realer than waiting for divine intervention. And I'm thinking again of the comment that there is no divine intervention in Ruth. I'm holding alongside that a memory that the Ukrainian poet Ilya Kminsky shared last week, recalling the kitchen conversations he overheard as a child between his parents and their friends. I am not a religious person, but I do believe there is a divine in us, he remembers them shouting. If there is a church I am willing to subscribe to, it is the church of the kitchen table at 33 Savetskaya Militsia Street, apartment 1 in Odessa. That's where, on Sunday nights, they crowd around a table and shout at each other, "Is there a God?" Maybe, if you look a certain way, the Book of Ruth is full of divine interventions. They come less in the form of cloud-parting miracles and look more like everyday works of God with and through us. Later in his book, Pedrego Tuma writes that the stories of God we receive through sacred text are often of those who dared stretch the meaning of God into the terrible circumstances they were surviving. The divine interventions in Ruth are the decision to stubbornly remain with someone you love, the ability to find an imperfect path through dark times, the choice to pursue what you want, taboo or not, the willingness to help a foreigner find their way. During my few weeks of reporting on Ukraine, two of the people I talked to were children. The names were Maria and Alina, and they were 15 and 10. I was put in touch with them as they were leaving Kyiv, where they had been born and lived their whole lives, and were driving to the border with Poland. They were going to continue on to Germany with their mother, while their father would remain, along with their grandparents, who were too old to travel. They were three women and girls crossing a border during a time of crisis, circumstances that are not so different from those of Ruth and Naomi. The last time I spoke with them, they'd reached Munich, and I asked them if they could tell me one thing they remembered from their journey. I figured they might tell me about something sort of memorable that they'd seen along the road, but this is what Maria said. I remember the hospitality of the Polish and German people. The volunteers were great at helping everyone. They'd understand what you meant with barely a word. Just ask, and they'll feed you and give you water and take you wherever you need to go. We just didn't expect so much. We share the sermon at St. Lydia's. So we're going to have a time of silent reflection, and then you'll be invited to share a story or an experience that was sparked by the text or by what I've said. We share stories rather than opinions because Jesus told stories, and stories help us to know one another better. I also ask that you notice whether you're someone who often speaks first and to perhaps pause and make space for others. If you don't often speak up, that time is for you, if it feels right. So let's begin with silence first.